This podcast contains coarse language, adult themes, and spoilers.
My name's Peach, and for the past couple of years, I've been helping my friend Shag overcome his childhood aversions to everyday foods in the podcast Fussy Eater. Now it's his turn to help me conquer my phobia of scary movies over one spooky night in the FBI studios, one Wikipedia synopsis at a time. This is Spooko.
Look, social media is fine, and there are sometimes interesting things on it. And one of the things that, look, I'm sure the term viral doesn't mean anything anymore. It's just come to mean popular.
You know. And you know what? You know what? That's a really interesting point. And it basically does mean that, because nothing can really truly go viral anymore because the internet and social media are so fragmented that there are huge memes that I'm sure neither of us have ever seen. There are songs that have hit number one on both the TikTok and Spotify charts that neither of us have ever heard.
Mm.
Virality as a concept doesn't exist in a world where we all live in completely different online spaces.
So there's a non-viral but popular interview with Jack Black that the algorithm has served me a couple of times. And you'll be familiar with the contemporary incarnation of Jack Black, who's, you know, slightly, like, because he's such an impish, youthful sort of character, seeing him in his older age sort of energy, like, even he carries with him a little bit of a sort of mournful post-childhood sort of energy that he seems quite self-reflexive about. And he was interviewed for something, and the excerpt the algorithm served me was like, hey, I've got School of Rock. It was like, hey, I made a number of different movies over the time, some of them good, some of them bad, some of them medium. But I had a moment where I made my magnum opus. I had a moment where what I could bring into the world was really distilled into one thing. And it brings me such great pleasure to, you know, apart from some things were okay, some things bad, some things good, to be able to turn around and look at this one work and say, yeah, I made that. No one can take that away from me. That's really deeply fulfilling. And that, of course, brings me back to the Nightmare Method. Jack, I really like the Nightmare Method. I think it's going to be the thing where I sign out of this thing and I go, you know what? Like, did a few things, was drunk on a few episodes of early Spooko, then decided didn't really enjoy the drunk episodes that much and didn't do one for 3 or 4 years. Might do one, you know, in the next year or two, who knows? But Nightmare Method, pretty solid podcast, Shag, and it can be our School of Rock if you're happy to follow that analogy with me.
I mean, no, 100%. I mean, I firmly believe that the best thing you can do in life is make stuff and make stuff for the sake of making things. And I genuinely think, like, you know, no matter what happens in our lives, Peach, we will always have Spooko episode 100 maybe. And
oh yeah,
the Nightmare Method season 0 episode 4. It won't be out for a couple of months, but it's already the best episode of the Nightmare Method.
Is episode 4 the best episode? Which restaurant is that?
That's the it's the one where Gordon has
sorry,
the book of rules.
Oh, sorry, we don't do spoilers for Nightmare Method. Sorry.
Well, no, we can do a very slight spoiler. It's the one where Gordon has a book of rules that becomes the framing device
That's
for the
right.
episode.
That might be the funniest thing, apart from having dogs barking while trying to record a podcast. It might be the funniest thing I've ever been involved in. Shag, you just take the wheel. I just continue like I'm here. You just tell a nice, amusing story that I can come in and be like, that's pretty crazy. So, Shag, you take the wheel.
You know what? Speaking of social media, though, sometimes social media sucks. And one of the things I think we've been very careful about on Spooko is trying to be very clear on what we believe in what's happening.
Oh, what a crazy story. Shaggy, like, it gets better in the retelling every time I hear it from
Actually,
you.
Actually, no, you know what? You know what's really funny, Peach? I want to get, not serious, but, like, you know, I'm talking about how much social media sucks and how much there's so much anger and vitriol online at the moment.
Ah.
Whenever anybody mentions anything about Palestine and Gaza specifically. And, you know, we actually recorded an intermission earlier this month.
Yes.
That I didn't end up putting out because I was like, you know what? I don't want to create something that's inflammatory when we haven't had time to properly go, this is what I want to say. And this is what I think we should say here and why I think we should say it the way we're saying it. So
just confirming, I haven't had a chance to review whatever it is you're about to say.
Yeah, so I'm just speaking on behalf of us.
Yes.
I worry about long term the damage that this online vitriol everyone is having will do. Mm. The fact that anybody mentions something and you get so many comments from different people with different perspectives just being really like angry and passionate and upset. Mm. And I think when you break it down why this conflict has been such a flashpoint, especially for young people, I think it comes down to something John Glazer had to say about dehumanization. Let me take a few steps back, right? Like, so we're a podcast recording out of Sydney.
Yes.
Oh, well, I am recording out of Sydney. You used to live in Sydney. You now live outside of Sydney, but you live in the vicinity of Sydney.
Yes.
Sydney is like a hugely privileged place. Like, we have
massive,
a relatively safe society. Obviously, you know, depending on where you were born and where you grew up, like, compared to the rest of the world, things that we're pretty lucky here. Mm. We generally have more money than the rest of the world. Australia is incredibly wealthy.
Yes.
And you can't have those things, right? Like, you can't have us being in such a privileged situation, being very wealthy, having very convenient lifestyles without there being an underclass of people somewhere in the world who are toiling and laboring for us to have the lifestyle we have here. Mm. It's funny. You sent me a bit of friendship homework, which weirdly enough was Tom Morello speaking on a talk show where he was basically like, where all these people were like, capitalism's amazing. It's got heaps of people out of poverty. And it's like, yes, but if you are going to champion capitalism, you have to accept that it needs to have people who are hugely poor doing the work for the people who are reaping the benefits of that labor.
I want to let you get to your watered-down version of whatever inflammatory things I said about Palestine, but it reminds me of the, you know, this like weird sort of like motivational speaker who was really trendy like 15 years ago and sort of still lingers around in the culture, Tim Ferriss. He wrote this book called The 4-Hour Workweek, and I just like, I listened to this great takedown on it on If Books Could Kill, this great podcast that that Stu sent me to, and big thanks to Stu always for that, where it's kind of like you make a 4-hour work week by paying like heaps of people around the world like pathetic slave wages in order to do all your work for you. And it's like, yeah, you get the 4-hour work week.
Yeah, exactly.
And these people are spending their lives doing your shit.
To live these lifestyles, to enjoy this life, you have to accept that. Like, you have to be like, that's a thing that happened so I can live this life. Like, people are paying slave wages on Uber Eats so I can have whatever restaurant around me delivered to my door. Children probably aren't being paid around the world so I can have like $10 t-shirts from Kmart or even less, you know, like however much they cost, right? And where that comes from is maybe it's not direct dehumanization, but it's indirect dehumanization where we're not actually thinking about these people as people. We're not considering that these people are real people like us who were born, had a childhood, potentially have made it to, you know, adulthood, have dreams, have things they want to do, have a life, have experiences, and they just happen to have to do the labor to allow us to have the lifestyle we have based on the system we're living in. The more you think about people as real people, the more you want to change that system. The more you think this probably isn't right? In the same way, I think what's been so heartening about seeing how Gen Z has responded to Gaza is the fact that they've basically been seeing video after video of pretty poor-seeming people.
Are you going to edit me calling them war crimes, Shag? We're an anti-war crimes podcast? Or?
No, but Peach, here's the thing. Like, I can't Like, I don't want to get into, like, the terms that are disputed, not because I don't agree with them, but because my worry is people are just coming out here with takes, and it doesn't do anything except get people angry. And, like, and I don't know where that anger is going to end up, right? Like, I don't know. And that's what I'm worried about. And where I'm trying to get to is that a director, Jonathan Glazer, had a really great take where he was just trying to find a thing that anyone can agree with, which is basically like, please do not dehumanize these people. And I genuinely think the way Gen Z is responding to this, everyone's like, Gen Z's like supporting terrorists or whatever. It's like, shut the fuck up. Gen Z are just seeing videos of people being torn apart in their houses and their lives being torn apart by these weapons of war that the countries they live in are sending. You know, Australia is supporting these weapons going over. America is supporting these weapons going over. The UK is supporting these weapons going over. And they're saying, we don't want that to happen because we're seeing real people be affected by that. That's literally it, right? Like, that is literally it. It gets to semantics where people get really upset. You know, even with this speech that I'm about to talk about, you know, like, Jonathan Glazer literally wrote a film about the Holocaust and Nazis being so dehumanized to what was happening that they could build this perfect life for their family streets away from a concentration camp. You know, we spoke about this before. We're both never going to see this film because we would never have time to sit through an actual film. Like, when would that happen?
I'm trying to make time to watch some sport, though, so that's handy.
But he literally made a film about it and had this speech where he's like, that wasn't supposed to be a historical film. It was supposed to be about something that I think is presently happening now, where we dehumanize the victims of these conflicts. And all I want people to do is to stop pretending these people either are collateral damage or they're human shields, or they just deserve to die because the people they voted for, just to remember that they're just people, no matter what happens. That's all I want, right? Like, he had this speech, and the reason why I'm wary of, you know, using terms like war crime is after this speech, there was like 1,000 people signed an open letter taking him down, being like, you'll never work in Hollywood again, essentially. Not because he said we shouldn't dehumanize people, but on the semantics of what he said. I think he used the term occupation, which I understand is disputed. So this is kind of my point, right? Like, I loved what Jonathan Glazer said because he tried to be like, he tried to put it at its most basic level. He was like, either you accept that these 30,000 people have to die for whatever reason, half of them children, or you don't accept that and you think there must be a better way for what's happening in the world for this to proceed. And it doesn't, like, any of your answers about it's complicated, it's this, it's that, or whatever, doesn't matter. It comes down to the fact that, do you accept that these people had to die? And if you don't, then maybe we can find common ground there, which I loved.
I'm very, very wary about any sort of online discourse that is like takes two to tango, two sides to the story. You've got to, like, be balanced reporting type stuff. I don't want to make a lot of space for the British or Australian or American or Israeli government to go like, no, just hear us out on why killing 30,000 people, half of them children, is a good idea. Like, I'm opposed to contributing to any message that suggests there's a dialogue of two, you know, interesting competing ideas, both of which are equally reasonable. And I guess that's why this is about the least passionate I've been talking about this issue, Shag. I imagine I said some fairly incendiary things on the episode that we won't end up airing. But I think that's what I'm really passionate about, is what I perceive to be the risk of making. You know, each side has their story about this, and it's like, let's hear two sides to it.
But Peach, this is what I'm trying to say. This is what I'm trying to say, is that the problem with the internet, the problem with this, is that people who want to turn it into a two sides thing do, and then it becomes fucking atrocious discourse, where what Jonathan Glazer was trying to actually do was be like, hey, like, surely we can all agree that 30,000 people
as
just been killed.
Point. Yeah.
Surely we can all agree that maybe we need to accept that they're real people. Like, surely we can all agree that we shouldn't just put them aside. We should accept that we should at least consider them as real people. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's the most basic term to be like, these people have died in this conflict, mainly orchestrated by the countries we're from. And all he was trying to say is, it's like, I want people to remember that these are people. They're not enemies. They're not terrorists. They're not human shields. They're not collateral damage or whatever those things. First and foremost, they're people. And if you can start with that, then hopefully that's something that we can agree on. I guess my point with saying before is like, I'm not trying to be like, I want to hear the arguments why they did have to die. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm trying to say is, it goes back to that idea of, you know, living in this country. It's like, there are some certain things, it doesn't matter. Like, you have to accept. If you take a certain stance on this conflict, then you have to accept that those people had to die. If you take that certain stance. That's what I'm trying to say. And that I think is a very interesting and compelling argument. And I think a lot of young people are like, I don't think those people had to die. And I don't want that to happen. And anyway, so how this leads into our episode today, is, yes, I mentioned that that fucking 1,000 signatory open letter from like people in Hollywood taking down a speech from an indie filmmaker at an awards ceremony that has been year on year declining in viewership, even after Chris Rock got punched by Will Smith, is that Eli Roth, one of the enemies of this pod, fucking signed that. And here's a man who has never taken responsibility for anything he's ever done in his life.
Yep.
When the original Hostel came out and people questioned why he had to use such extreme gore, his answer was, people see worse things on the news.
Yes.
Right? Right?
Yes.
But now people are seeing worse things on the news. He signs against Jonathan Glazer, not to be like, hey, these people dying are real people, but to be like, you used a word that I find pretty insulting, so therefore you probably shouldn't work in Hollywood again.
So he's gone from, as I might have said before, being fairly anti-war crimes. I think the undertone of his, you know, time discussing Hostel was not in support of the war crimes. He was saying, people see this stuff on the news, and I'm not necessarily in support of that. I'm comparing it to the torture, the negative things I'm showing. So his 2006 view was, the stuff on the news is bad, similar to the bad, you know, scary things I'm showing in my film. His view now is like, oh, now I've had time to think about war crimes. Like, I'm pretty interested to see where it all goes. And I think you need to hear two sides of the story on it and not use language I don't like to talk about it.
But not only that. So, after the Hostel films, he made a film called The Green Inferno. It's a cannibal film. It's also like super extreme. It's also like a little bit like making a cannibal film about a lost tribe of cannibals in the Amazon. Ooh. I don't know. Like, I get that it's a genre, but still just feels not cool.
I just don't know how anyone's trying to make a cannibal film now that charcuterie's out in the universe. Like, I sort of feel like it's kind of like, now that we've announced it, anyone thinking about a cannibal film just now needs to just cool it, see how charcuterie goes, and then be like, all right, well, what's the next step for the genre?
But when he wrote it, when he released it, he was interviewed about the main premise, which is a bunch of people who want to save the Amazon go to the, like, a bunch of rich, privileged white people go to the Amazon because they want to save it. But then they get captured by this cannibal tribe because how dare you believe in things? Like, an interviewer was basically like, because it was around the time that people used the term social justice warrior. And the interviewer was like, is this your takedown of social justice warriors? And he was like, yes, it's exactly that. Because I think a lot of people just basically type out an opinion on, you know, their social media or whatever, and then they don't really stand behind it. And look, I agree with people who will stand up for their beliefs and stand behind it. I just don't agree with these SJWs, as he said. And yet here's a man who risks his career at the Academy Awards to stand up for a pretty, like, let's be fucking honest, with all the takes people have had on Gaza, I think it's pretty tame to be like, hey, can we just accept that people are people and, like, have inner lives, and, like, when we kill them, we're killing a real person and not just a number on, like, a military stat sheet? And he then signs his name to take this person down. Like, I can't stress enough how much this guy sucks. But at the same time, it is sequel season, and I really like the Hostel film. So, Peach, today, today we're doing Eli Roth's 2007 sequel to Hostel, Hostel Part 2.
Free Palestine. Am I allowed to say? You don't have to edit that one out, Gooey. I can say that one.
You can
we'll
say
see.
That one.
We'll see if it stays. Thank you.
There are so few safe places left in Europe. So where are you going? On a little spa vacation?
Where?
Slovakia. They're the best natural hot springs in the world.
Wow, hot springs? That sounds so therapeutic. I want to go.
It could be nice.
Okay, we'll go.
Do you know of a good place to stay?
What is this place? This place. People come here. People come here to kill people. What?
We don't like Quentin Tarantino, do we? Pretty sure we don't.
We
have beef with him.
He doesn't seem like a great guy, but I do enjoy Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained.
Yeah, okay. That's the one with Eli Roth in it.
Yeah, Eli Roth is in Inglourious Basterds.
Okay. Yeah, all right, Shag, let's do it. I'm sorry about all the interruptions. It's very racial. The trailer was like, here's my view on various different races and how much they're going to cost.
Oh, my God. This is the other thing, right? So this film is set in Slovakia. Well, this film series is set in Slovakia. And the Slovakian government were basically like, hey, Eli Roth, I'm not sure it's cool you positioning Slovakia as this scary place where Americans get kidnapped and killed for sport. And his reply was, hey, like, most Americans don't even know where Slovakia is. It's a satire on them. And it's like, no, if most Americans don't know where Slovakia is, all you're doing is creating a view in their minds that they don't know anything about it of what this country is. He's actually, you're usually the one starting beef, but it's like, he just sucks, except he makes some cool movies.
I just think he doesn't believe in anything. Like, I think that's the biggest defense I can make of him. If he just says whatever comes into his head at the moment and is offended about whatever he decides to be offended about in the moment, and so has no values or value, no internal life to speak of. He's purely about the aesthetic, the immediate. And I suppose if I was to spin that into a compliment, someone who's purely about sensation, purely about just doing whatever on earth he wanted, it's a pretty, you know, spot on metaphor for someone who's like, you know, it's an interesting idea. Just people who can do whatever they'd like to people who are completely dehumanized. It actually feels fairly internally consistent with the universe of Hostel and the brutality within it. And I presume the brutality we're going to find within Hostel 2 seems pretty consistent with this pretty fucking profoundly shit bloke.
I mean, that's such a good point, right? There's an argument that him being like this allows him to make entertaining horror films. Do you know what I mean? And I think the Hostel universe is really enjoyable as a horror fan. I'm going to set the stage because obviously we're in sequel season. We haven't done Hostel in a very, very long time. But the basic premise of Hostel is that there is this secret community called the Elite Hunting Club. The idea of the Elite Hunting Club is they're a business that procures humans for people to pay money to go into a room and torture and kill however they see fit. Now, the rules that go, once you've signed up for it, you have to kill someone to be able to leave the kill factory alive. So you can't just sign up and chicken out. You have to sign, and chicken out's probably the wrong word. Like, moral out. Good.
Yeah, I follow that.
You have to brave out. But you have to, so you also have to get a tattoo of Elite Hunting Club somewhere on your body. So you're now part of it. Like, I think they do a good job. You know, we've talked about this before in how to start a snuff business. I think they've done a good job of how to, like, keep customers from breaking their NDAs pretty successfully, right? Like, you can't go and tell someone without going to the cops and saying, well, I killed someone. And the proof is I've got this tattoo from the company.
Yes. You know it's a real compliment because it's to Eli Roth, who I have no positive things to say. I actually think that's fairly artful and fairly well considered, right? To sit down and reflect of like, okay, well, how would this illegal secret group self-police, and how do you make sure no one goes and snitches on the elite hunting club? No, I think that's actually fairly sophisticated.
And the way that they procure people are through hostels. So they find ignorant Americans traveling in Europe. They invite them to Slovakia to these hostels that essentially become the sort of pre-hunting grounds to bring them to these kill factories. It's all a pretty seamless story. I enjoy it. And in the second film, they try to go to the other side. So the first film was all focused on the victims. In this film, there's sort of two stories. There's the victims and the customers who pay to kill somebody in a hostel, which I think is quite an idea.
Yeah, okay.
Do you know what I mean? Like, this is the tricky thing. It's like, this is a really great film series, I think, if you're a horror fan.
Yep.
I also think the marketing was excellent. Peach, I've had this thought for a while that horror posters are able to communicate so much more than regular film posters. I'm just going to share with you the initial poster that was eventually banned for Hostel 2.
Yes.
And just tell me your gut reaction. I'm putting it in the chat here.
So just while I've got you, did Big Audio Dynamite have any like lasting impact on culture? And is it the guy from The Clash? It's their new project.
It is the guy from The Clash, and no, they didn't.
Like, there was like, wasn't there two great songs? Have you ever played them in clubs? Yeah. And do people freak out and it's great, or no one cares?
I mean, you probably could. At the moment, people like fast dance music that has like that they can just like. It's gone very much back to like house music and even spent like hardcore and things like that. So at the moment, no. Yeah. What do you think, though? See this poster. How does this make you feel?
Makes me feel slightly gross / it's a piece of brisket, butcher shop sort of energy, which I guess is consistent with what he's trying to convey.
The other piece of market, I mean, I don't know if this is strictly marketing, but it feels like it was marketing. Apparently, somebody leaked a rough cut of the film. It got sold to in various DVD markets around the world and was named as some New Zealand magazine. I don't know where they got their stats, especially in 2007. How the fuck would you get stats like this in 2007? But apparently it was the most downloaded film of all time. Like, that's the sort of buzz that video nasties really need to get people excited about.
Yeah, so that's your real here's the Pirate Bay link type era. Yeah, absolutely. My mate's got it on his hard drive era. Yeah, I follow.
Yeah, it's like, have you seen this film? It's so extreme. It's so extreme that everyone's downloaded. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it was very cleverly done, and it still tripled its budget in the box office. Like, it did really well. And I think it's arguably the better film of the franchise. There is a third, but it weirdly enough, it's not made by Eli Roth and it sucks. And again, like, more praise to him, where it's like, he knows how to make a great film that's not easily replicated by others if they try to use the template. Anyway, all right, so let's do this.
If we get to talk about Eli Roth films, can we go back to listening to Kanye music? You don't have to answer that, but I just thought I'd float that.
Oh, this is a really interesting one, right? So I did listen to Vultures, and I wasn't impressed, but I also was just feeling weird about Kanye in general. And somebody I really respect messaged me and was like, hey, like, I actually think you should give Vultures another go. And I was like, really? I'm a bit grossed out by him. And she was like, yeah, me too. But for some reason, I've now become sort of obsessed with this album. Like, that's not a reason. I don't know if that's an answer to it, but I think it doesn't matter what we do or don't. I think the world is shifting slightly. I think things are changing in how people react to people being awful people in the limelight.
And sorry to sidetrack and pinball around. Kendrick, Cole, and Drake, who have you got?
Well, no, didn't you hear that J. Cole's apologized for his track?
Like, I'm so glad I'm on record as being like, J. Cole sucks. Like, fuck, it's the most like, yeah, it just.
This is a tough thing because like Macklemore in many ways I think is really awesome, but also that's a real Macklemore move, I think. Like, I think Macklemore's actually Macklemore like a really thing. Good dude. Like, I think he's probably a good dude. I also think J. Cole's a good dude, but I think Macklemore's a really good dude, but I don't respect him as an artist.
Like, J. Cole's retraction speech as well, he's like, oh, just really stressed me out. And so I decided to just not stand up for myself. And I was like, man, that's fine, right? Of like, and do you remember during COVID? Yeah, anyway, he's like beef with like proper like activist, like no name, that Chicago rap. Anyway, J. Cole, like, I'm so glad we're on record as saying like J. Cole stinks. And I've got Drake, but Kendrick's very good.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, right? Like, I think you can have beef with people, but I think it's the same thing with Eli Roth, right? At the end of the day, he's not just these, like, shitty moves he's made. He's also a person who's made some really great films.
Mm. And as Jonathan Glazer would tell us, we should treat him as a human being.
Anyway, look, let's do this fucking film. I've got 20 minutes before I have to go to a meeting. Let's do this.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Following his escape from the elite hunting club, Paxton, who was one of the heroes from the first film, suffers from PTSD and lives in seclusion with his girlfriend, Stephanie. After an argument where Stephanie denounces Paxton's paranoia as exaggerated and insufferable, she wakes to find his headless corpse in their kitchen. Soon after, an unmarked box containing Paxton's severed head is delivered to the elite hunting club boss, Sasha Razimov.
How much research went into naming that sort of Russian-coded person? Yeah.
Come up with a Russian bad guy. It's like, oh, Sasha Razimov. Like, that's what happened. That's how you name that person. All right.
Sounds like a Borat character or something.
Fuck, let's not even go there. Ugh. Let's not. But that's a whole other thing to unpack. Anyway, all right. In Rome, three Americans. So before we get to the main plot of the film, what I like is how they tied up the last film. It's like, there's no loose ends because even after you escape this place, you're tormented forever, and then they eventually find you and kill you.
Look, Eli Roth, like, if he gets compliments from us, he's earned them. You know, it's good.
I love this. I love that we've created a bar, so when you compliment Eli Roth, we know that it's meaningful.
Yes.
I love that we've done this in this episode.
We're good. We're good at podcasting, Shag. We're the real nightmare method of horror film podcasting.
In Rome, three American art students, Beth, Whitney, and Lorna, are convinced by Axel, a nude model they are sketching, to join her on a luxurious spa vacation in Slovakia. The four check into a hostel where the desk clerk surreptitiously uploads their passport photos to an auction website run by the elite hunting club. And then we have this awesome montage where we cut to all these rich people around the world viewing their laptop screens, their desktop screens. Oh, I don't know if it's phone screens in 2007.
That's another good idea as well.
Yeah, like bidding on these people that they can go and kill. Like, it's cool. Like, again, I don't necessarily agree.
And in 2007, that's fairly sophisticated. You know.
Super cool, right?
Fucking Eli Roth. Yeah, okay.
It probably doesn't predate eBay, but imagine if he predicted eBay. My God, imagine if he was like, I wonder if this is how people will be buying and selling. Not really just people they want to kill. All right. American businessman Todd and his best friend Stuart win the bids on Whitney and Beth and excitedly travel to Slovakia. Later that night, at the village's harvest festival. Now, this is one of those things where it's like Slovakia is basically this old-timey, essentially medieval country where like there medieval are villages and they have harvest festivals. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's all just a bit like, it's not a satire on Americans anymore. Like, it's really not. I don't know how it really is.
He doesn't understand his own point. He just says things to move on to the next phase of the conversation. You know, he doesn't think it's a satire of Americans. Like, there's just nothing satirical in here. It's just a lie.
After being taken to a secluded area downstream, Lorna is kidnapped and awakens to find her. Okay, so there's always like one first awful kill in a hostel film.
Mm.
And she awakens to find herself having been stripped naked, bound and gagged, and hanging upside down.
Oh, God.
Another woman enters the room, disrobes and lies naked beneath Lorna. Okay, ugh. All right. So this is actually like...
We're back to actually like first 5 or 10 episodes of Spooko Feelings. Actually, I haven't felt this for a couple of hundred episodes.
This is really bad. And I mean, again, like he did his research. I think this is based on a historical figure who did this for, or did something similar to this because she believed that like young women's blood would give her more life or something. Yeah, anyway,
it's the kind of thing that happened in the Iraq war, as Eli was telling us.
we saw it on the news. This woman lies under Lorna, who's hanging upside down, before using a long scythe to repeatedly slash Lorna's back, torso, and eventually her throat, all whilst reveling in her dripping blood.
Mm-hmm. That's actually, like, I mean, fucking Eli, I hate Eli Roth. Like, but that, like, that's really good. I hate that I appreciate that as a good horror death. That's a really good way to start this movie. I wish it was worse than that. It's such a satire on, like, witch culture or Wiccan culture or something. Oh,
meanwhile, Beth, Whitney, Axel, and a local man, Miroslav, head to the spa to relax. Beth falls asleep and wakes up alone and without her belongings. While looking for her friends, she is pursued by several men and flees the spa. In the woods, she's ambushed by a gang of violent gypsy street children. Again, I don't know how I feel about that.
Oh, come on. Does the Wikipedia synopsis use that word for the Romani people?
It uses the term. And in fact, I should say, it uses that term.
Okay. Yeah.
But is saved by Sasha and Axel. After both ladies leave, Sasha executes one of the boys as punishment. Later, at Sasha's remote mansion, Beth is pursued by the men from earlier, whom she realizes are associated with Sasha and Axel. Looking for a hiding place, she discovers a room filled with human trophy heads, one of which is Paxton's, before being captured. Which again, it's just like a nice little detail. She wouldn't know it's Paxton's head, but I like the camera shows us that to like be like a little knowing wink at us.
I feel like this is a really good movie, Shag. I wish it wasn't. I'm pretty impressed so far.
Before being captured, taken to an abandoned factory and tied up in a room, Beth is soon joined by Stuart, remember one of the guys that bitted on them, who is supposed to kill her, yet appears reluctant to do so.
I expect we are trying to be led to empathize with Stuart. But I like...
No. We're not. They are the bad guys in this.
Okay, good.
We are led to emphasize... Like, no. They are absolutely the bad guys in this. It has a clumsy anti-patriarchal message here.
Mm-hmm.
It truly does.
Okay.
It's pretty spelled out at the end. You'll see. In another room, Todd terrorizes Whitney with a power saw, but loses his nerve... After he brings it close to her head, it gets caught on her hair, it slashes her face and partially scalps her without killing her.
Yuck.
So she's still alive, but her head is just gore. And he's like, oh, I can't do this anymore. Horrified, Todd tries to leave, but is informed that he must kill Whitney before leaving. Todd refuses and tries to leave anyway, but the guards release attack dogs which tear Todd apart.
That's fairly satisfying.
The elite hunting club then offers the maimed Whitney to the other clients to kill, including an elderly Italian man who is eating Miroslav alive. I can't believe we just read this every week. We read shit like this to each other.
Again, like it's upsetting. Also, the idea of eating someone alive, like there's a reason, especially if you're elderly, like that's difficult. I mean, even just to chew, like, you've got to prepare, like, if you were to eat a pig alive or something, even just getting through the skin.
It would be tough, right? Like, it would be hard to just eat plain human skin.
Like, if you think about how husbandry has worked, you eating me, a 42-year-old man, that makes me about, like, 40 years older than the most mature beef you've ever eaten. Like the state of the meat on any adult person would require really serious and proper preparation in order to be digestible, I think. I don't know how you go about eating raw human flesh, especially if you're old. Teeth are all gammy.
Stuart, after learning of Todd's death, shows Beth the pictures of the maimed Whitney to frighten her, then accepts the club's offer, leaves Beth, and beheads Whitney. Meanwhile, Stuart, who has now officially made up his mind, prepares to torture and kill Beth, explaining that she bears an extremely close resemblance to Stuart's wife, whom Stuart hates but has never had the opportunity to kill, which I'm like...
Oh, my God.
I don't love having a character who is that... Like I just worked on a campaign for coercive control, which is becoming a crime in New South Wales this year, which is a form of abuse which pretty much often leads to violence and often leads to a partner killing their romantic partner, right? And in a sort of like crappy entertainment film, like a grindhouse film, like this is what this is, right? It is a grindhouse film.
Yeah, it's shit.
We know it's not a satire.
Yeah,
doesn't like, and he knows that. Like this is, it's just dumb entertainment, right? And it succeeds at that. But having a character like this makes me feel not great.
No. God, I hate Eli Roth so much. What a fucking pig of a guy. Anyway, yep, sorry.
Stuart then begins to torture her, but Beth is able to seduce him into untying her from the chair.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, wait. Let's just get through this together, Paige.
Okay.
Stuart attempts to assault her, but she fights him off and chains him to the chair. Sasha and the guards arrive at her cell, where Beth offers to buy her freedom with part of her inheritance. And though Stuart tries to outbid her, Sasha reveals that he knows that Stuart cannot afford to do so. After Sasha tells Beth that she must kill someone before leaving, she cuts off Stuart's entire genitalia and leaves him to bleed to death, throwing it to the dogs. An axe that gives pause to even the jaded guards. Satisfied, Sasha gives Beth an elite hunting tattoo as a tramp stamp, weirdly enough, making her an official member. That night...
Yeah, okay. Can we just kind of linger on that? Like, I can imagine that's a very malformed, ancient attempt at doing something liberating.
Yeah. But, do you see what I mean? Like, it is... I think it is trying to say something here.
Well, trying... Like, I don't want to give him that compliment. Like, to actually try, you need to think... And as well, take advice from people who know more than you. You need to have the humility to reach out and seek advice, which he does not have. And I'm certain he has not done. And so he's done probably less than the bare minimum, like to make a feminist statement or a progressive statement of any kind. But I think he's satisfied himself that he's done something progressive and worthwhile, when in fact what he's done is to reinforce pretty ancient sort of rape revenge film kind of tropes, I should say. So no, I'm not prepared to sit here and let any compliment like that go towards Eli Roth. I think he might have pleased himself. He might have given himself some pats on the back, but I'm not prepared to add to those pats. Even though I'm sure this is fairly satisfying to watch it. I was like, yeah, eat his dick, dogs. That's awesome.
That night, Axel is lured by... So remember, she's the model that brought them to Slovakia and got two of the three of them killed. She's lured by the street children into the woods, where Beth ambushes her and beheads her with an axe. Shortly after, the children start playing football with her severed head. And, all right, I just...
That's like an anti-Slovakian statement as well. Oh, come on.
But I also want to make a point about this where it's like... Have you ever tried to play soccer with an Australian football? So like an oval shape, like you can't, like a football has to be perfectly round for it to roll, for it to react the way you need a ball to react in a game of soccer. So you can't play a game of soccer with someone. You just couldn't. You couldn't kick it long enough.
It's like, and it's too heavy.
It doesn't make any sense. Yeah,
too hard. It hurt your foot to kick. It's ridiculous.
But anyway, that's the thing. It's like this is a genre film. Like that ending really does say, you know, despite anything you might have thought I was trying to say, this is very much just a silly genre film. Peach, what did you think of Hostel Part 2?
There's a degree of wasted opportunity generally. I feel like there were real proper attempts made to do things that are within Eli Roth's skill set about world building and about stitching together a narrative. And so I find the world building elements quite impressive. I even find the idea of a victim turning into member of the elite hunting club quite a nice sort of inversion. I like the internet element of like, here's how you generate a market for this stuff. And so from a purely superficial, from a prima facie analysis, I don't have a lot of problems with it. And I suspect it's a very does what it says on the tin and perhaps a step past absolute complete trash horror. It sort of just edges into just watchable horror and into the top echelons of that kind of watchable grindhouse type horror. It's, I guess, peeking under the hood and having a reflect and reflecting on the creative process and the creator behind it, where I'm really irked and discomforted. It's a work from a person whose politics can be read back from it. And when I say politics, it's just the politics of convenience. It's just whatever jumps into his head. And so the idea of an organization that dehumanizes and tortures people probably comes quite naturally to someone who just recently opposed another director from talking about how great it would be if we could stop dehumanizing people. So, Shag, I imagine that's kind of the central metaphor at the heart of all this, of maybe we shouldn't have been surprised to see Eli Roth saying, no, of course you shouldn't humanize some people. Some people just aren't human.
Hopefully we'll see you next week, as long as Eli Roth doesn't sign an open letter denouncing the contents of this week's pod.
Yeah, sign the open letter, Eli. Let's read it. I'll check it for typos.
This was recorded at FBI Studios. Please like, subscribe and follow wherever you can and as much as you can. And Reshes, what's up?